Hello, everybody. Welcome to our Dharma Geeks Buddhist psychology session. It's the 5th of December in the United States of America, but here in Australia, it's the 6th of December. It's Friday lunchtime. So, you know, we in Australia have always been a bit ahead of the curve. So, yes, I'm glad somebody thinks it's funny. So we are going to start as usual with a little bit of practice, and as usual I think we'll probably be joined by a few more people. So let's find your meditation posture. And bring your attention to present moment experience, whatever's happening in your body, in your mind, in your environment. Awareness is the essence of meditation. I suspect you've heard that before. So just simply bringing this knowing, cognizant quality of our mind to our experience. And being with whatever's happening. And from this place, we can connect to our motivation, the inspiration for us to engage in these practices so that we may be liberated, freed from suffering, and be able to devote our efforts to caring for others, supporting others, helping others to also realize their true nature. This altruistic, compassionate motivation we call bodhicitta, the cause of enlightenment. Okay, so as I said earlier, welcome everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Wonderful to see so many familiar faces. Happy that you're here. We have just opened the second module of the immersion course, and as you probably have already discovered, we are into the four noble truths. Or as I've learned to understand, they are probably better translated as the four truths of the noble ones. We'll talk a little about noble ones as we get to the end of this. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. The four truths of the noble ones. And so if you have had a look at Stainless Prajna, Rinpoche Rinpoche's wonderful little text that he wrote as a practice guide for the Abhidhamma, you will see that Rinpoche ties together the three types of suffering. suffering of change, suffering of compounded things. The three poisons, greed, hatred or aversion, and delusion, excuse me. And the three Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant or unpleasant. I think that's the first time I've ever heard those three sets of three linked together in this way. It really points to the matrix or matrices nature of some of this Abhidhamma teachings. We can cut the pie so many ways. So I hope to explore these three sets of three in greater detail in this talk, focusing on the first noble truth. I won't really get into the other three, but the first noble truth, and specifically why the Buddha said the first noble truth is to be known. So I hope my effort's not too ambitious. We will find out. So the Buddha said the first noble truth is to be known. I wonder what he meant by that. Because I think it's important, particularly in the context of liberation. There's a way in which completely, totally understanding the nature of the four noble truths, or particularly this first noble truth of suffering, is the doorway, the key to unlock our the cage of suffering, to liberate us. Without knowing the first noble truth, we can't really better understand its causes, nor the path, nor the prospect of liberation. So understanding the importance of knowing suffering is critical to achieve a direct realization. So I think for most of us, it's not difficult to realize that life has challenges. Yeah, who anybody not have some difficulties in their life? Who's fortunate enough not to be challenged by some, you know, those of us who are now septuagenarians definitely know about suffering. It shows up in parts of our body fairly frequently. We all experience difficulties, either physically, emotionally, financially, familiarly, our families. We all know that things can get rough. Things suck. Yeah. That's another great word for dukkha, a definition of dukkha, things suck. But I think there's a deeper meaning to this. As I mentioned earlier, the Buddha talks about three types of suffering. And Nyingma Rinpoche, in his articulation in Stainless Prajna, speaks to I think it's page 11 or 12 or some 13, speaks to these three types of suffering in somewhat detail. And so I want to take a closer look at each one of these three types of suffering. And as I said earlier, explore them in the context of how they relate to the three root poisons and the three Vedana. So the suffering of change relates to the root poison of greed and relates to the Vedana of pleasant sensations, pleasant feelings, right? That's the way those three line up. So impermanence is a big topic in Buddhism. We all know that. Anybody who's practiced Buddhism for any period of time, meditated, particularly if you've also done the Joy of Living Level 3, the Vipassana teachings as offered in the Togar curriculum that come to us from this wonderful tradition of Mahamudra, you will have learned about impermanence. Nyingma Rinpoche introduces this notion of permanence and impermanence in the context of, excuse me, what he calls the unhealthy sense of self, this notion of permanence, and the healthy sense of self, this notion of impermanence. So while ever we cling to this understanding that things are permanent, the self, other things, while ever our reality consists of things that we don't want to change, or we wish that they do not change, then we are going to suffer. That's what's embedded in this understanding of the suffering of change. And our task through these Vipassana practices to see the true nature of things, but and in this case, on the relative level, to see how all conditioned things are impermanent. The Buddha said, and this quoting from the Pali Sutra, "Sabbe sankhara anicca." All conditioned things, all things that are caused, all things that come into being based on causes and conditions, and that pretty much is everything except nirvana. By definition, all conditioned things are impermanent, subject to change. Will come into existence based on causes and conditions, will evolve based on causes and conditions, and eventually will disappear based on causes and conditions. That's the nature of all conditioned things. In the next module in the Buddhist Psychology Immersion course, we'll begin to work more closely with the meditation practices that Mingyur Rinpoche introduced back in August. If you attended the weekend retreat that Rinpoche did back in August, second week of August, or whenever it was, and we did those, you might remember. We began by counting the breath and following the breath, et cetera, et cetera. So beginning after Christmas, we start to get into those practices in some really deep dive. Of course, it begins those exercises with the breath are really shamatha practices, connecting to the breath. They serve to develop a capacity to stabilize our mind, to bring stability to the mind in order to be able to be with present moment experience. Funny, I did a talk for the teacher training program on wisdom a couple of days ago, and I've become fond of quoting my dear friend Tim Olmsted, whom I'm sure you all know and love dearly. And I've mentioned this before myself in some of the things that I've said, where Tim says that we are beguiled by appearance, this word beguiled. All the display of our experience, all the stuff that we encounter. This display that is possible because our mind is cognizant and knowing, aware, radiant, clear, all of that stuff. The problem is that because of our confusion, we get caught up in it. We get beguiled by it. We get carried away by it. And so it's important for all of the methods that we learn from all, many of the Buddhist traditions, that one of the common themes of method is beginning with shamatha, with calm abiding, shinne, meditation, developing the capacity to stabilize our mind so that we are not carried away by our experience. So the practices that we will begin to do following the breath or counting the breath, etc., are the beginning of shamatha. And the third module, at the end of the first course in the immersion course, that'll, I think, somewhere probably we'll get there around the end of March, concludes with the introduction of Vipassana. We begin to turn our mind to inquire into the nature of our experience. And one of the first things we notice when we examine closely is that our experience is constantly changing. All conditioned things are impermanent. This is understood as one of the universal characteristics. We've heard that already, right? I think we touched into that in the essence course. You may, if you've certainly if you've practiced Vipassana in the Theravada tradition through either the Insight Meditation Society or Spirit Rock in California or any of the other Goenkaji, any of the programs that have been offered from the Theravada tradition really emphasize the universal characteristics: impermanence, suffering, and not self. Anicca, dukkha, anatta in Pali. And so this is one of the things that we see. All conditioned things are impermanent. And as we stabilize our mind and direct our attention towards our experience, this is one of the first things we see. It's constantly changing. It applies to everything except the caveat, nirvana is not changing. As Mingyur Rinpoche says, it's not permanent and it's not impermanent. It's beyond concept, nirvana. So why is it important that this truth of the suffering of change or impermanence should be known? So now I'm going to go and draw on some other teachings that you're probably quite familiar with. The loving kindness, compassion teachings, and we're talking now particularly the four immeasurables, the joy of living level two teachings, if you've done participated in any of that programming. And this understanding that everybody wants to be happy. We, and it's part of the expression of our true nature, we are endowed with inherent wellness, well-being, goodness. And part of the way that that expresses not just awareness, this knowing quality of the mind, but also this very subtle movement of the heart to wish to optimize our well-being. We all want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. So we are constantly seeking to find this happiness. Because things in life may not be, we may not feel completely fulfilled. We may not feel complete. We may not be at ease. We want to be at ease. We want to feel complete. We want to be in a state where nothing, there's no deficit. We want nothing more. That's the nature of this expression of our innate well-being. But thanks to this pernicious thing called impermanence, right? We are constantly seeking happiness, but we miss, due to our confusion, we think that pleasant things will make us happy. This is where we're beguiled by appearance. We mistakenly think that pleasant things, now we're into the pleasant Vedana. We mistakenly think that it's things that are pleasant and you've got them, you know what you find pleasant. Or whether it's art or music or chocolate or coffee or sex or, we all know what we think is pleasant. And we've all, particularly if you've lived for a few decades, you all begin to realize that a lot of this stuff doesn't really deliver what it promises, right? That's part. And the reason why it doesn't deliver what it promises? Because it's impermanent. This is the suffering of impermanence. This is at the core of what these teachings are. And so, we have these habits to seek pleasure, but getting to know that it's going to lead to suffering, this is why the first noble truth is to be known. As soon as we get something we like, we then have to worry about whether we will lose it or whether someone or something will take it away from us. We try so hard to create the conditions of happiness, but due to the first noble truth and the law of entropy, for the scientists, things are constantly coming undone. This is the suffering of change. It is to be known. And so one of the best ways to know it, as I mentioned, is the practice. sit on the cushion and watch the ever-changing nature of our experience. Sensations in our body come and go. At one moment the pain is here, or the tension is here, or the burning is here, or the itching is here. The next minute it's somewhere else. It comes and it goes. I mean, if you've spent any time, like the time on the cushion, you know what I'm talking about. Our thoughts and emotions the same. One minute there's these crazy thoughts coming this way, and then the next thing we go, we're all of a sudden we're onto some other topic. And every time we think about something, it elicits feelings. Oh, I like this. I don't like that. I hate that. Oh my God, I regret that. You know, this is what happens when we sit down on the cushion. Our moods and our states of minds go up and down. I like to say the tide comes in and the tide goes out. That's really the vicissitudes of life. We find ourselves chasing after pleasant experience, pleasant Vedana, only to feel good and then have it disappear. This is the suffering of change. This is driven by the root poison of greed, and it has to be known. That's what the Buddha's saying, right? So that's the suffering of change. Excuse me. But as you will recall in the teachings in the Joy of Living level 2, not only do we want to be happy, but we also want to be free from suffering. We do not want some incoming nasty thing to rob us of our well-being. You're right? We're constantly kind of like, get out of my face. We do not want unpleasant things. But guess what? Things happen. Much of what happens, we have no control over. Our body gets injured, we get sick. We all know about sickness. Our loved ones suffer, they get sick or encounter a misfortune. There are natural disasters, storms. We just had a big earthquake in Northern California. I don't know whether there was any damage recorded. Our relationships break up. We get into accidents, someone hits us, you know, when we're active, or we cut ourselves, or we injure, break a limb. And then other people we encounter in the workplace, in our family, in our neighborhood, etc., might treat us poorly or abuse us. And even if it's not abuse, there's probably somebody out there that gets under our skin. We don't like it. It annoys us, right? This is unpleasant vena. This is, and it's connected to the root poison of hatred or aversion. The unpleasant Vedana arises and we wish to avoid it. You know, get away, go out, get out of my face. This is the suffering of suffering, the second type of suffering that the Buddha talked about. And it similarly has to be known. And what better way to know it than through our practice? When we sit on the cushion, not only is everything constantly changing, but our back aches, we're itchy, our mind races, we get hungry. On and on it goes, right? If you've done any extended period of practice, you will know, you will see all of this sort of stuff. So much of this stuff. And we sit there engaged in some, you know, thesis about how we're going to fix all the problems. I've certainly done that on retreat. Dreaming about how life will be so much more wonderful when I can get away from all this suffering. The suffering of suffering is driven by the root poison of aversion or hatred. And it too has to be known. So this suffering of change, you know, when we want something to be a certain way, we may achieve it or we may acquire it, or it may be elusive. The suffering of impermanence, right, has to be known on a deep level. And then all this nasty stuff that comes at us that we don't want, that we really have no control over, that we have to be able to open up to and deal with in some way, the suffering of suffering. These are the first two sufferings, and the first one is related to pleasant Vedana and greed or lust, avarice. The second one is related to unpleasant Vedana or aversion and hatred. And so these forms of suffering are linked in this way. And it's interesting to see that that they also connect to this notion of loving kindness and compassion, the desire to be happy and the desire to be free from suffering. And it's not that the desire to be happy and the desire to be free from suffering are the problem, because they're really just the expression of our Buddha nature trying to bring us back to our true nature. The problem is that due to our ignorance, due to our confusion, we don't see, or we mistakenly interpret or act out of our desire to be happy by chasing after pleasant things. And we mistakenly act out of our desire to be free from suffering by getting into a tug of war, a fight with that which we don't like. That's what these teachings from the Abhidhamma are telling us. And I'm sure you can relate. So enough of the first two sufferings. We get to our final suffering, the suffering of compounded things. And this is where it gets a little more challenging, difficult. It was interesting. I really enjoyed the way Rinpoche talked about it in Stainless Prajna. Oh, but again, we're linking this third suffering of compounded things with ignorance, the third of the root poisons, and probably the primary root poison, which will be evident when we talk a little bit more about this, and this feeling tone, Vedana, that is the third one, which is neither pleasant or unpleasant. And from my own experience, this third feeling tone was really, really nebulous. You know, I could very easily relate to, you know, chasing after pleasant things and running away from unpleasant things. I could find a litany of pleasant things that I wanted and a litany of unpleasant things that I didn't want. But what about this neither pleasant or unpleasant? If you've heard Nyingma Rinpoche teach, I think it's even in The Joy of Living, certainly in The Path of Liberation, he talks about the four boxes, you know, which is the philosophical, one of the models in the philosophical schools of Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhism. You know, it's either yes, no, neither, or both, right? Or both or neither. So we're talking about this box of neither. This feeling tone, this Vedana of neither pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, although I don't like the translation neutral. this notion of it being the negation of either or, I think fits much better with the philosophical schools and much better with the characterization of ignorance as it relates to this Vedana and its connection to ignorance and delusion. So it falls into this box of neither. And that's where the problem lies, because if it's not something, right, we really struggle to identify it. We're back to how the conceptual mind creates our reality, how our perception overlays concepts, this notion of the sign, nimitta in Pali and Sanskrit. It's nearly like as though the way we create our reality is we put a handle on everything. We create a conceptual overtone that serves to identify objects that through the repeated conditioned application of that concept reifies and makes real that thing. That's the way the brain works or the mind works. And it's like we stick a handle on it and we call it a table. And the handle is the label, the concept, or self. It's true of all subject. It's true of the subject, and it's true of all the objects as we understand in relative reality. And by making it real, by reifying our experience, then it becomes a thing. And then that thing, we're in relationship to that thing, and therein gives rise to our afflictive emotions. And so this is the primordial ignorance that's talked about in this tradition. And it's not just primordial ignorance, it's true that's how we got into samsara, because we mistakenly saw or misinterpreted the luminous, radiant, knowing capacity of our mind awareness. We miss the self-luminosity and the other luminosity. Ooh, I've talked about this in a number of occasions. We've separated those two, created subject and object, when it's just the luminous, the display of the luminous nature of our mind. And we reify that, we make that real through this process of identification, of placing a handle on stuff. And so this is the ignorance, and it's really hard to see this. It's really hard to connect to this Vedana, well, this box of neither pleasant or unpleasant, neither this nor that. So I found it really interesting when Rinpoche talks about this in Stainless Prajna, and he says, I quote, "The suffering of compounded neutral feelings cannot be realized by ordinary beings, but are taught to only be the experiential domain of realized beings." In Sanskrit, Arya, or as translated, noble ones. And so this refers to the noble ones, where I translate the noble truths as the truths of the noble ones. And here again, this is why this translation is important. The truth of the suffering of compounded things can only be known if we are in this class of beings called the noble ones. And what is the class of beings called the noble ones? The Arya Sangha. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Arya Sangha. I'm sure you've heard that, right? The Arya Sangha are the people who've had a direct realization in some way. And what does direct realization mean? Mingyur Rinpoche talks about this in the context of the path of liberation, but here in the context, you will see that it's referred to as the noble ones of those are those who have attained stream entry, or the first stage of light enlightenment. And so here, these teachings, Vasubandhu's treatise on the Abhidhamma Kosha, that comes to us from the Vaibhashika Satantrika schools of the Savastivadin branch of Buddhism, circa the 3rd century or whenever it was in India, up there in Kashmir or wherever. These schools were known as the Shravakayana, or the hearers. The Shravakayana was the being or the vehicle of the early Buddhism. It's referred to in Theravada, it's referred to in the Mahayana as Shravakayana, and kind of the vehicle of the hearing, the listeners. It later, the Mahayana tradition coined the term Hinayana, which I think is a little pejorative, a bit of a put down for the Shravakayanas. That's why when you hear Mingyur Rinpoche talk about the Hinayana, he'll refer to it as the foundational vehicle rather than the lesser vehicle. Although those of you who have been in Vajrayana circles for years will most commonly have heard it referred to Hinayana as the lesser vehicle. And so the distinction is that a Shravakayana, or someone on the Shravakayana, can become an, when awakened, when having a direct experience of the unconditioned, will become an arahat, whereas someone on the Mahayana path, whose motivation is that of bodhicitta, when they have a direct experience of the unconditioned, they will become a bodhisattva. So there's a, it's not synonymous, but there's a connection between the stream entra and the first bhumi. If you have bodhicitta as your motivation, you, when you have a direct experience of the unconditioned, you will become a bodhisattva, enter the first bhumi of the stages of the bodhisattva. If you're in the Shravakayana vehicle and you've not got bodhicitta as your motivation, you will become a stream entra, which is the first of the four stages of enlightenment that leads to arahatship. Interesting. I know when I did my postgraduate studies in Buddhism, this was going to be my thesis for my master's, but Mingma Rinpoche asked me to help run Turgar, and I dropped my thesis and never finished it. But this comparison between stream entry and first bhumi was, I think I'm of a 20,000 word essay, I think I still have 4 to 7,000 words somewhere in a file on my laptop that I never finished. But this was my conclusion that I come to, that I was going to explore further, was this distinction, because in many ways in the text, the treaties that support both the Shravakayana traditions and the Mahayana traditions, the texts speak to this moment of direct realization or stream entry. The characterization of what takes place in the mind, as in the direct experience of the unconditioned nirvana, as being very, very similar in both traditions. There's minor differences, but for all intents and purposes, there's a pause in the conditioned nature of experience. And there's this gap where one realizes or has a direct experience of the unconditioned. And so I was really like, well, how come if the Theravadins, the Shravakayanas, describe this experience this way, and the Mahayanans describe the experience this way, and for all intents and purposes, it's the same experience. What distinguishes between whether you become an arahat or a bodhisattva? Good question, huh? It came to my mind. I thought it was a good question. And my conclusion was motivation. If your motivation is to become enlightened as an arahat, you know, kind of a loner, then you become an arahant. If your motivation is bodhicitta, to become a Buddha, then you become a bodhisattva. And yet this experience is essentially the same. So what Rinpoche is saying is that in order for you to know the truth of conditioned things, this the suffering of the compounded things, in order for you to know that, you have to have this direct experience. Or that's what the Shravakayanas are saying. And so I'm assuming it's the same applies for the Mahayana path, although I'm just assuming that. I may be false in my belief or perception around this. But the suffering of compounded things is to be known, but can only be known through the direct experience of the unconditioned or nirvana, a glimpse into the unconditioned. And in both the Shravakayana and the Mahayana traditions, they speak of this event as kind of irrevocably transforming the mind stream of the yogi practitioner. Things, some of the basic poisons are uprooted, primarily doubt. But the greed, hatred, and delusion, the three root poisons, are mitigated, and doubt about the path is removed in that moment of direct realization. And of course, this relates to the third poison, the poison of ignorance. And it makes sense in some way, because in order to uproot the third poison, ignorance, one has to have the wisdom. And what's the ultimate wisdom? The ultimate reality, a glimpse of the ultimate reality. If that makes sense, we must have the direct experience of nirvana to uproot ignorance, to irrevocably transform the nature of ignorance that's embedded in our mind. Yeah, so I've waffled on here, haven't I? But that's my best attempt to explain to you why this first truth, the first noble truth, or the first truth of the noble ones. And you can see now why it's the noble ones, those that have experienced direct realization or have a direct experience of nirvana. They're the ones that are the noble ones, and only with this understanding can you truly understand the first noble truth. So that's why it's the four truths of the noble ones. I forget who it was that I was reading that suggested this was a better translation, but in the context of this, that makes sense. And so, but we, whether we are Arya or not, we've attained the direct realization, we can still know the truth of suffering, of impermanence, the truth of suffering, of suffering. And in actual fact, it's if, as non-Aryas or non-noble ones, that is our path. That is the key. Because if we really look at the suffering of change and the suffering of suffering, at some point we will want out of samsara. This, you will know at some deep level within your being, in your bones, boy, this thing called samsara and this deeply habituated tendency to chase after pleasant and to run away from unpleasant sensations really is exhausting. And in the classic literature of the Shravakayana, it talks about becoming disgusted with conditioned reality and wanting out to and because in the Abhidhamma, consciousness is conditioned. It is said that consciousness, the mind, takes nirvana as an object. Now, that's completely contrary to the later teachings that come to us in Mahamudra. But we get so disgusted, and it kind of speaks to this whole notion of renunciation, right? True renunciation comes about because we become disgusted with conditioned things, because it's always changing, it's only suffering, it really sucks. So why am I clinging, right, to samsara? How about we find the unconditioned? Wouldn't that be nice? So this is why the first noble truth is to be known. Whew. So we've got 15 minutes left, and I'd be happy to entertain some questions if anything that I've said kind of sparked something in your mind. You are most welcome to raise your virtual hand or your physical hand if you can. Bruce, have you got your Bruce Hilton? Is that you I see with your hand up? How you doing, Bruce?
Doing good. Got in late tonight, but you were talking about irrevocable transformation, and I was looking at it the sense of becoming fully conscious as to being reactive, unconscious, and stuff like that. So by saying irrevocable, does that mean you will you will not be able to fall back into the reactive state.
Exact
Okay.
amount. There is, it comes in degrees, and in the Shravakayana, there are four levels of enlightenment: the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arahat. And so it's not until you get to the arahat stage that all of the kleshas, all of the poisons are uprooted. But at the first stage, the root poisons are reduced or mitigated to some extent, and then further reduced at the other three levels, and or other two in the next two levels, until completely removed at the level of arahat. But it's said that you are guaranteed, I think, seven lives after you become a stream enterer. I think you're guaranteed seven lives and you'll become an arahat. I think that's what it says in the Shravakayana. And you can never, so that process is irreversible. You can never become an ordinary being again and be endlessly lost in samsara. You're guaranteed an off-ramp.
That's good. I've been doing the JOL 2 8-week class, and tonight that question came up in my mind, and you answered it for, but anyways,
Right.
so that's
Thank
good.
you.
And I
Happy.
won't be late anymore, well, after next week, because that's the last class for the
Oh,
JOL.
great. Hi, Pam. How are you? I see you got your hand up. You need
Okay,
to
there we
unmute.
go.
There you go. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple of questions that have come up. I think I kind of have the answers, but I'm still a little confused about it. So, the first question has to do with a lot of the Buddhist text. You will hear about do not cling to a friend. Do not cling, period. But specifically, don't cling to friend, don't cling to family, don't cling. And especially with this idea in Mahayana Buddhism about bodhicitta and really having an open heart for others, there it's I would love to hear your perspective on the nuance between having deep bodhicitta without it moving into any kind of clinging. So when I see on the surface, when I see Shakyamuni Buddha leaving his wife and child to go meditate under a tree, yes, of course, his father was a king, they were rich, they would be taken care of, but he kind of split and left them on their own.
He was a
Okay.
deadbeat dad.
Yeah, from one perspective, you say he's a really shitty dad.
He's a deadbeat dad, yeah. He'd be have to pay alimony in today's society. You'd take him to court.
Exactly. So it was kind of like, that's interesting. Yet, of course, if you do attain enlightenment, it's the best way to help other sentient beings, apparently. So I've been, don't know, through direct experience. So it's
Yeah.
where that nuance between the, bodhicitta on the Mahayana path and this not clinging, like I think of not clinging to my mother, not clinging to my husband, not what does that look like, and what sacrifices would you actually make that makes sense for your own spiritual development without hurting others? So I kind of like about maybe I'll run off and do a 3-year retreat. My husband's hair turns white when I say that. So it's, these things are like, where the, yeah, anyway, I think you get it.
Yeah, no, I get it. Definitely get it. I think it really depends on how you understand clinging. Of course, we all find the ones we love are dear to us. It's understandable. And when they suffer, we suffer. I mean, everybody who's got a child has, anybody who's got a pet has experienced that, and if you don't have empathy to others' suffering, you're a psychopath, essentially. Anybody who studies psychology knows that. The whole mirror neuron concept of what goes on in the mind when you're faced with someone suffering. It's understandable that, and because we all want to be happy and nobody wants to suffer, and if we really connect into that, then there's this natural response to care for those who are suffering. That's bodhicitta in some way. But clinging, I think, is not what is, or it, what you see there is not necessarily clinging. We haven't, and I'm not sure that we will touch on the 12 links of dependent origination that's embedded within the Shravakayana Abhidharma teachings. But we've talked about Vedana, right? We have these feelings, what's pleasant and unpleasant. And then what immediately follows that in the 12 links is craving and then clinging. Craving is tana or trishna in Sanskrit, and then clinging. And the clinging, as I understand it, is more relates to what I was talking about a few minutes ago about the handle, the sign, the way we make real our experience, subject and object, right? In order to be able to make a chair, our mind needs to cling to the concept of chair. Without the concept of chair and without our mind imputing that on that physical form every time we see it, whether it's a bus or a car or a person, a man or a woman or a flag or a building or a, you know, all appearances are clung to by virtue of the sign, the label, the concept that we bestow upon it. This is what, and this is the way we create samsara. And this is what's meant by clinging in this case.
So conceptualization and labeling, which is one of the five aggregates, is what you're saying is the clinging.
Yes. Well,
and how do you function in the world without that?
Well, there you go. You have to become realized, and you will find out how you can function in the world without that. The point is that these teachings say, and it's not just clinging to the concept. Conceptual mind is the way we reify the clinging. But we're clinging to our feelings. We're clinging to our body, our sensations. We're clinging to our thoughts. We're clinging to our consciousness. All of this through the process of identification and appropriation. That's the way we make this real. That's the way we create the concept of self and other, all based on this delusion that we see self-luminous aspect of the mind and the other luminous aspect of the mind as being distinctly different, when they're just the display of the luminous, radiant aspect of the nature of our mind. And so when we can see beyond that, beyond this dualism, and the subject and object dissolves, we are still there, we are still operating, we can still care. But in the union of that clarity and emptiness, you know, if you've studied the practice, the nature of mind is the infinite capacity to respond. But in order to have the infinite capacity to respond, we can't be continually engaged in the action of collapsing the radiant display of the mind into a thing.
Yeah, it's a nuanced boy. When I try to practically apply it.
Yes, well, because it's non-conceptual. You can only experience it. You can't figure it out. It's beyond, the ultimate truth is beyond concept. It's beyond our capacity to make sense of it. We can only know it, experience it, and be it.
Yeah. That's a good answer. That's great.
I'm glad my answer was good. I feel good now.
Pleasant, good pleasant for me.
Vedana. What? Pleasant Vedana. I better not cling to it. But thanks. Great question. This is good stuff. You know, I love this stuff. I love this as a, you know, as a lens to explore our experience. Isn't this amazing? You know,
I
just
love
be
it.
Able to, you know, to sit there and see this. You know, it can be a little tedious and it is quite complex, but incredibly revealing. And the beauty of it is, as you begin to see all of these bits and pieces and understand it as just causally related, well, what are we clinging to? It's empty and it doesn't have any inherent existence. What are we clinging to? Why are we so desperately fixated on this being the way things are? And you have to ask questions at that level in order to go beyond. You have to be able to question, understand the way you're doing it, and challenge your proclivities, tendencies, habituated tendencies for making it real this way. You have to challenge that in order to be able to have direct realization. That's why the first level truth needs to be known. We've got a couple of minutes. Any last question? We've got one time for at least one more. Catherine, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm very well. It's a beautiful day here in Australia. The
Oh,
sun
it's
is
a lovely
shining.
evening here.
Christmas is coming. Everybody's going to spend Christmas on the beach here.
So my question is, it's probably jumping ahead to what you said about practice in a while, but I find it, I don't quite find the space of analytical meditation on kind of relative reality very easily. I can find a space of a kind of focus, and I can find open awareness. But when I try to analyze anything, I can't really distinguish very well between thinking and analyzing. And then if I just try to be with whatever it is, that feels a lot more like somewhere between open awareness and or nature of mind and, it's a kind of just being.
I think maybe we maybe misperceive analytical meditation to be just thinking about. We need, there's awareness needs to be there, otherwise it wouldn't be meditation. That's why the capacity, developing the capacity to apply our mind to be with our experience, the shamatha aspect of it's really important. Once we've connected to the experience, then we begin to look. And it's not so much thinking it, but it's like examination, investigation, inquiry. There's a curiosity about what you're experiencing. That's the vipassana, that's the analytical meditation. And particularly when you juxtapose your misperceptions that you begin to, that things are permanent or things are solid or whatever, when you begin to undermine or examine the misperceptions and then the wisdom dawns, oh, it's not the way I thought it was. Oh, look at that. That's constantly changing. Or look at that. There's the aggregate of this or the aggregate of that or the Vedana of this or the element in the body, whatever. You begin to see all these constituent components and how they're just causally related and unfolding, and the sense of self or the me, the control of the identity of all of this kind of begins to dissolve in some way. And that's the way wisdom works. It's not that we're so much thinking about it. It's nearly like, because what have we not heard? That wisdom is inherent. It's kind of a stealth practice in some way. It's not something we can impose. It kind of sneaks up on it, comes in the back door and sort of says, ha, look, you were wrong. How foolish are you? And this is see what's being revealed here because you're looking at it from a perspective in some way. That's the way the wisdom works. It's not so much we as engineers, as lawyers, as accountants, we're always trying to figure it out. Right, that's not what I understand analytical meditation to be. It's more this notion of inquiry. It's an intelligent investigation, examination of how things are, and the wisdom reveals itself because it's innate. Goodness gracious me, we've gone past the top of the hour. That can't do. So we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for your time again. It's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. I'm really enjoying this program, as you can tell. I'm in my element. So yeah, look forward to seeing you online and seeing you in these heart to hearts and Dharma Geek sessions somewhere in the future. But let's just take a few moments to reflect on our time together. How fortunate we are that we have access to these amazing teachings and that we have a teacher, Mingo Rinpoche, who can illuminate them in such clarity that he does. We are truly, truly fortunate. And so we can develop some gratitude. How fortunate, yeah, how nice, how wonderful to be part of this community, to be part, to be blessed by the understanding from these teachings. So whatever time, whatever virtue, whatever goodness may have been derived from our time spent together today, let's dedicate to the welfare and happiness of all beings. May they quickly realize their true nature. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Edwin. Thank you very
Thank
much.
you so much.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
See you around.
Thank
Take
you,
care. All the best.
Edwin.
Bye.
Bye.